but we do understand that it is occurring. And I think that on this program, over the years, with a series of guests and perhaps ill-advised experiments, we have proven, along with Princeton and all the others doing this kind of work right now, that there is a power, and it's a definite, real power. It's now a measurable power. In other words, the actual power of it, the field, the size of the field can be measured. So we're getting down to some real nitty-gritty in terms of the world of consciousness. Just remember, it was here. Humanity's fate may be in its own hands. That may be the bottom line to all of this. Humanity's fate may be in its own hands. We just don't know it yet. Brian in Orlando, Florida says, "Hey Art, my brain feels like a set of bowling pins and the good doctor's the bowling ball. Got any Excedrin?" Yeah, Brian, I know what you mean. But here's the thing. I think, so many of us listening to this program right now, know this is true. We know this is fact, that there really is something here. And here comes Professor Tiller with a lot of very hard proof, and a lot of it dispensed to us in the language of physics that other people at his level would understand. And we might not necessarily. I did not certainly follow it all. But the hard numbers behind the experiments that it seems to me are irrefutable. I mean, irrefutable in terms of what they prove, very hard for anybody to ignore. If you would like his latest book, which he claims he held the math to a minimum in, it's Some Science Adventures in Real Magic. And you can order it, let me do it the right way here, by reading you the number here in the good old U.S. of A at 888-281-5170. That's 888-281-5170. People need to get these publications and get them into the hands of other scientists who need to begin also doing experiments like this. Or outside the country, the number is 620-229-8979. That's 620-229-8979. I got that right, didn't I, Professor?
You got it perfectly.
Yeah, good. I'm going to introduce you now to the audience, which will probably slow you down a little bit, which is a good thing.
Probably is.
Here we go. Let's see what's on their minds. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi. Hello.
Oh, is that me?
That's you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bell, for taking my call. Professor Tiller, can you hear me all right?
I can indeed.
Okay. Your experiments are definitely amazing, and I have a two-part question that hopefully you won't be as reluctant to answer as you've seemed to be on some of Mr. Bell's questions, but my question concerns your meditators. The first part, have you measured the brainwave states and which is the best for imprinting, whether it's the beta, alpha, theta, or delta? And the second part of the question, what type of meditation are you basically using to imprint the information? Is it a visual meditation or using a sound meditation? Thank you very much, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. With regard to the brainwave state, did you do measurement in that area?
We did not do any measurement in that area. That's sort of in the future kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that would occur somewhat far down the road. Basically, the answer to the second question, my wife and I began meditation by learning the Edgar Cayce technique that the people from Virginia Beach talk about. And this was back in the early 1960s, and it's a very simple one. And we've transformed it so much over time that it's unrecognizable, but that's where we began.
So you believe you have come, advanced it to a more efficient, effective...
Well, it works for us, and we have changed it several times during the last 35 years, 40 years.
Do you think that's just tailoring it to you specifically,
yeah,
or a general advance?
No, I think it's tailoring it to us specifically, and it optimizes for us because we're evolving all the time. And so this seems, again, intuitively you're led to making various kinds of changes because you more quickly get to the state where the house lights go up very, very brightly inside fairly quickly.
All right. Well, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Professor, you are amazing. I had studied very briefly Edgar Cayce before, but moving on, the two questions I have specifically concerning to define and then condition the environment. But and also, what was the...
Wait a minute. What's your...
I didn't quite catch that.
Either did I. What is your question about conditioning the environment?
Yeah, I was just concerned about... I was wondering about the conditioned environment. How do you define and then how do you condition it?
Okay.
And then...
Hold on.
And then backwards...
No. Caller, hold on. Okay. Professor, how do you condition the environment?
Well, the way which we condition a space is to use... an IID with a particular intention.
IID is what?
This intention-imprinted electrical device, this simple device I talked about.
In the beginning, okay.
In the beginning. And basically, for example, when we wanted to condition the laboratory here, I built a new laboratory in Payson when
yes.
we moved here from Stanford.
You did
back
what?
In 1998. And the intention that we used was that the laboratory be lifted to a higher electromagnetic gauge symmetry state, as high as possible, and to be tuned so that any psychoenergetic experiment conducted in the laboratory would be robustly successful.
In other words, it was a blast of intent, caller.
The intent.
Conditioning that environment, yes.
The intent. So now this is really basic. As an electronics technician, the EEPROMs that you influenced, obviously.
Yes.
Were they basically empty or like all zeros or all ones when you started?
Well, we didn't check that kind of thing till later, but we did have an electrical engineer look at that, and there was some random, little bit of random stuff, but not much, and it changed while it was conditioning a space. I mean, you could see those numbers changing, and we have to do a lot more work on that at this point in time because we don't understand enough, and we want to design a better device. So that is an important point, but we don't have enough information for me to give you really good hard data.
Professor, let me say that there's nothing like the power of positive thinking. First of all,
yep,
and second of all, when you talk about magic, I mean science.
Yes.
Science and magic are two different. There is no magic. It's all science.
Oh, it's all science. But
yes.
But it is. The dilemma is if it's well beyond the prevailing paradigm.
Might as well be science. Magic.
Yes. You really have to use those words because only then can you understand why people are rubbing their heads so much and that they can't really accept it easily. Because to them, they're stuck in a particular mindset,
mm-hmm.
and they just have to look at it as magic. They just can't believe it. That's the problem. But it's a very human thing, I believe.
But if there is evidence at the level that you claim,
right? Yes, and we have really substantial evidence for all of this now, and
it goes with the work at Princeton. Professor, it seems to me that you would have some reason to communicate with Princeton and any others doing work in this field. I mean, remember the plant experiments?
Yeah, sure, with Cleve Baxter. Exactly.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, no, I agree. I communicate with all of these people. And so we're, in fact...
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, Bob John is reading my new book right now.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi.
Good morning, Art and Professor Tiller.
Hi.
A waft of names have come to mind with regard to the work you've cited, Werner Heisenberg and his uncertainty principle, John Bell and his extrapolations of the EPR paradox and action at a distance, mm-hmm. Brian Josephson and his application of the Josephson junction for squid technology, mm-hmm. Evan Harris-Walker, mathematical modeling
right.
of consciousness,
okay.
Carl Pribram. Let me revert back to Brian Josephson
right.
and his attempt to measure bioelectromagnetic phenomena. You mentioned high gauge developments with regard to the intention imprinted electrical devices.
Yes.
If we were to go beyond the squid, which is state-of-the-art for non-invasive measurement of bioelectromagnetic phenomena,
yeah, I mean, that's
cognition, where do we go now in terms of the kinds of sensitivity we want to depict those subtle aspects that
okay, well,
someone like Roger Penrose would be looking at?
Well, the squid and all of that, that's at the U1 electromagnetic gauge symmetry state, which really means that the U1 is that you have one internal space variable, which is the phase angle of the electron wave function.
Take that, caller.
But our experiments show that we not only have that level, but we access magnetic monopole level. And in exotic physics, the only place you see these electric monopole stuff and magnetic monopole stuff coexisting is at the SU2 level, where the internal symmetry spaces has to have two variables. And one is the electron wave function, and the other would be the magnetic monopole wave function in a perpendicular plane.
I'm going to have to take this caller away from you, Professor.
Yep. Sorry. Okay.
Because it's just that's...
Yeah, okay. Let me say one other thing. I won't be technical. It is that these spatial oscillations, which are global in a laboratory,
yes,
are very reminiscent of the Josephson effect. The frequency regions that we see these oscillations are in the range of 1/100th of a hertz to 1/1000th of a hertz. Very, very low frequency.
Well, I'll say.
We've almost never looked down there. And
it's a good point. We've almost never looked down there. It also would be a frequency that would traverse the Earth just like a hot knife through butter.
Well, that kind of thing is true. And so the gentleman who was talking about brainwaves and stuff, we never looked down, you know, even below 2 hertz, because it takes an awful lot of data to make meaningful sense of things.
Here. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi.
Yes, hi. A few years ago, I accomplished something that truly seemed magical/scientific, and I was wondering if the professor might be able to comment on how I might be able to increase my chances of pulling this off again.
Well, since we don't know what you did...
I'm going to tell you what I did.
Yeah, shoot.
I do medical research consulting and find alternatives for people's problems when they don't want to go the conventional route. And I myself developed a serious condition that usually is made worse by surgery, and I just couldn't find an answer, you know, just searching worldwide.
Right.
So I got an idea. I made myself a makeshift Ouija board and asked for a name and phone number of just, you know, some help.
Right.
And I literally got a name and number of a specialist, 1 in 20 in the United States, that I was unable to find. And it panned out, saved my life. And I was stunned. And it felt like a window of time opened up where this was possible. And I haven't been able to do it again, but it was so stunningly accurate that...
Okay.
All right. I think we both get it.
Yeah, and I don't have any difficulty with that. I find that if you're open to help from the universe, that you can get it in various ways.
But as she mentioned, it was sort of a small window of...
Yeah, well, the Ouija board thing is, I think, potentially dangerous, because you can access levels of the universe that you don't want to deal with. But I would suspect you got a pretty high level of the unseen to do that. You know, Edgar Cayce used to be able to go into a trance and say all kinds of things for people.
Yes.
And remarkable levels of accuracy over, you know, tens of thousands of readings. So potential is there. All the answers seem to be available in the universe. You have to learn how to access them, which really means that you have to go within. You have to build your inner muscles as distinct from the outer muscles. And you tune in to these other capabilities because they're present in the universe, and it is your subconscious that really accesses them for you. And the subconscious will feed you information that it gathers so long as you consider it to be meaningful. And in your case, you obviously consider it to be very meaningful and important for your life.
Life and death.
Yes.
It doesn't get any more important than that.
Right. And so I think, indeed, that if you begin to look at these kinds of considerations and these kinds of concepts, then you may be able to revisit that in a real practical way. Certainly as people develop within, what you're talking about is just a natural consequence of moving from a normal individual to an adept. I mean, mm-hmm. All of these things are latent human capabilities.
Got it. You've just got to know to grab them when they pass you by. On our international line, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Good morning. Hello? Going once, going twice, gone. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. All right. Before this show, I was actually doing some meditating as you were speaking about just about 1 minute earlier.
Yes.
And I don't know, you would probably tell my religion just by this, and I will not tell you my religion, but I received a message that said the devil was memory and Jesus was a wall of protection.
So, against what? Your memory?
Against your memory, which ties you down to earthly, you understand, earthly events and
it
feelings.
It can, but it doesn't.
And this is reinforced by Ouspensky. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yes, Ouspensky.
Okay. He states that memory is consciousness. The storage of memory, when disregarded for a couple of days or so, I believe, is when the energy may be transferred, or as you say, the information. So I don't know if you believe in spiritual. You said it's not spiritual.
Well, he said spiritual, but not necessarily specifically religious.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself an extremely spiritual individual, but I don't have much to do with organized religion.
Thing is, though, Professor.
Yes.
You have to acknowledge that if what we understand about intent and consciousness
yes.
is real, as
yes.
your experiments have proven,
yes.
that people with great religious faith would pray with incredible intent, with incredible intent. And so all these studies on prayer that show its effectiveness do
yes.
nothing but bolster up your entire argument. It's all the same thing, whether it's religious or not.
I agree with that. And the issue is that my concerns are the dogmas of religions that keep things in a very narrow channel and rather than letting them broaden. And I also talked about the dogma that's in science, being stuck in the conventional paradigm.
Fairly common practice. There are healers all over the world, and some of them seemingly really heal. At any rate, in this woman's case, she was in a small town. She was just an average lady in every other way, but she could heal. And all went along swimmingly until one day somebody in the town said, "Tell us that your power and what you can do is from God." She couldn't do it. They just about burned her at the stake. Real power or not real power, magical or not magical, they damn near burned her at the stake because she wouldn't say that her power came from God. And with regard to what Professor Tiller is saying tonight, I have a feeling we're going to run into quite a group of people just like that. Professor, welcome back. Your colleagues at Stanford University, when they became aware of the line of research you were doing, how did you fare? And I ask that question knowing that some other very important people who have done sort of off-the-wall, considered to be off-the-wall research, have actually been in danger of losing their tenure and even the position at university. I mean, just really getting into big trouble.
Well, the reality is they would have preferred that I didn't do this kind of thing. I did have tenure as a full professor, and I did my conventional work, and I had as many PhD students as anyone else. And
but they didn't come after you officially.
Well, there were no grounds, you see. The issue is that so long as you do what you're paid to do,
yes,
then the other is
good old American freedom.
Your private life, yes, right.
Yes.
And it was that kind of thing. But they would have preferred that I was at some other university because, in essence, it kind of embarrassed them, I think, in the sense that when they would go to conferences and people would ask them, what is this stuff that Tiller's talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't really answer except that they were bothered by it. But again, it's a very human kind of trait, something that's so very different from where their own power base is.
Now, I sense, maybe it's just me, but I sense between the kind of work you're doing in Princeton and other works going on right now that
yes.
all of this is kind of on the verge of coming out of the closet.
Well, I think, you know, we've got enough data but there has been a lot of data around, you know, I mean, there's been really a lot of data around for more than a century. But it's a question of data becoming really robust, and now we're getting really robust data. They are at Princeton, we are as well. And then it's really a question of getting some good scientists who are not afraid to go out of the box to really pay attention to this, to really look at it.
Let me tell you a danger you've got with it.
Yeah.
And that is that it becomes, I was joking, sort of, but not earlier when I played that bumper music, it could become a new religion.
Well, I mean, it can, and this is
right.
this is an aspect of consciousness. I mean, the point is that if you don't have enough, if your consciousness isn't high enough, then people will want to make a cult or a religion out of it. But if
well, that would be a healthy portion of the population, trust me.
No, I do trust you, and that is unfortunate. It just says where we are as a nation. We have a long way to go. But the issue is that this is the kind of science that, well, let me go back one step. My goal had been from the beginning of this work, to build a reliable bridge of understanding that joins seamlessly with conventional science on one end, goes all the way through the subtle domains and the domains of emotion and mind, and is firmly planted in the bedrock of spirit on the other end, and that it would be reliable enough that people would be willing to walk across that bridge.
Suppose I told you that you're going to have to tell me that this power that you've proven and talked to us about tonight comes from God, or if you don't say that, then you're going to get burned at the stake.
Well, the issue is, because I told you what my bias was in the beginning.
You, so you did.
I have no difficulty with God. God and I are on good terms, but it's not the terms.
So you are willing to say that this power, this ability, this phenomena comes from God.
Well, but in what
absolutely.
Way? As far as I'm concerned, everything does.
It's a safe answer, but there's got to be numbers for all this, and there's no numbers for God.
Well, the issue is we don't know enough. I mean, here we are, okay, we're just stepping beyond space-time to another level of reality.
So you believe God will eventually have an equation?
Well, I think we will slowly, over the next millennia, build equations for the domains of spirit, the domains of emotion and the domains of mind, and we'll get into the domains of spirit. So now, God as a concept, when I was younger, I had lots of ideas about God, but I realize at this point I'm not conscious enough really to have a meaningful image of God.
Right. No, I'm with you. We're ignoring people, and we can't. First time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi.
Yes.
Hi, you're going to have to yell at us. You're not too loud.
I'm sorry. Good morning, gentlemen. Professor, I couldn't help but notice that when you were speaking about your meditators imprinting the devices, that you noted 2, 4, and 6 individuals partaking in that experiment.
But I haven't studied odd numbers.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was a particular reason.
Significance to the even numbers.
There would really only that it just happenstance.
It was all couples and dogs.
There were two, when the four initial ones, which we published all that data in Conscious Acts of Creation, there were two couples. And then when we came here to Arizona and needed to imprint the lab, the other two people weren't available, so my wife and I did it alone, and it worked very well.
Professor?
Yes, go ahead.
If you had Ingo Swann there to conduct one of those experiments with, what would you expect?
Well, Ingo is a really powerful mentalist.
I'm aware of that.
And so he would do very well. But, you know, Ingo and I, we've been friends a long time, and we've often played bridge together, and he's tried to do psychic bridge, and he's terrible at psychic bridge.
He almost deserves rebuttal for that.
Well, I mean, he'll laugh, and I'd be happy to give him a chance.
All right. You know, the basis to the question was, is, in fact, a more powerful, more disciplined mind, like Ingo's, able to get a significantly statistically
signature
result? Yes.
Let's see. Let me go back one step. In the first book, Science and Human Transformation, I built a device that would respond to energies emitted from a human. It was a type of gas discharge device. And I found by looking at different people, the people who did best were sort of computer scientists, people who had very sharp, well-defined minds in that. Now, if we switch to the business of the meditation, it really is, I think, much more related to the devotion and the integrity and that you are putting into it, and your caring.
Oh, yes.
Your compassion for the whole.
Those are all the components of intent, yes.
They're all part of it, and so the I don't know quite how well Ingo would do in this, but I think he could train himself because he has.
I was going to say Ingo's he's going to care a lot more about your answer on this one than the last one.
Yes. Well, I mean, Ingo, in my view, is one of the really great ones.
Okay. Wild card line. You're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you were aware of any of the research in group consciousness coming out of Fairfield, Iowa, the Maharishi group?
Well, I'm aware of some of that work, and I know John Hagelin, and so I respect that work. I honor that work. I think that they've done some very nice experiments, and they're not unsimilar to the kinds of things that we have done. We've taken different targets.
They're trying to take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of Vedic pundits.
They're trying to take it to the next level, meaning what?
It's a group consciousness experiment in July.
What is the next level?
Well, there's the transcendental meditators. They meditate for 20 minutes. Then there's the yogic flyers, which is they're supposed to be that much more powerful. And then there's the Vedic pundits. And there's supposed to be 40,000 of them coming together in one place somewhere in the Ganges in July during this celebration called Guru Purnima. Were you aware of this experiment?
No, I'm not aware of it, but I'll look forward to the results with great expectation.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in India there are groups of swamis that are doing the kinds of things that we're doing with these simple little electrical devices. I mean, they've built themselves inside sufficiently that they do it. And our experiments have shown that the acupuncture meridian chakra system of all humans than probably all vertebrates, is at this higher electromagnetic gauge symmetry state.
Mm-hmm.
So the mind can modulate the chi flowing through that system, and that in turn can drive all the processes of the normal atom and molecule level of reality. And if they're coherent enough, of course, they can influence things outside the body. I mean, in the first book, again, I did work for about 4 years with the Institute of Heart Math. And
isn't the fact, Doctor, that your work has so much in common with the East Indian teachings going to put up another gigantic wall in front of its acceptance?
Well,
in this country.
Yeah, it might be. It seems to have a lot in common with Kabbalah, and I've been having contacted by lots and lots of East Indian fellows.
Exactly.
And these, I think that those two, let's say, groups, I think there's very good stuff down those paths. In terms of whether it'll be easily assimilated in this country or not, that's another question.
Answer, probably not.
Well, not quickly.
And not easily.
No, not easily.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Hi.
Good morning.
A little louder, please.
Yes, please.
Is that better?
Better, yes. Go ahead.
Professor Tiller, I was wondering, Art, and also real quick, I hope you stay with us. You know, you dropped out when you come on 2 days a week. And I hope you hang in those 2 days a week, because nobody can compare to you.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Professor Tiller, can you draw a comparison? It seems to me to be quantum physics is exactly what the field of research that you're in is. Or
okay,
can you draw a distinction between the two?
All right. Okay, very good. He's exactly right. That circles back, and I said that to you, and you said, but.
He's exactly right, and he's exactly wrong.
Okay.
Okay. No form of quantum mechanics, as it is presently framed mathematically, can deal with any psychoenergetic process. There has been lots of money spent by the military to try to use remote viewing to see over the horizon. And doesn't matter what kind of quantum mechanics they've used, it doesn't work. And the issue is that if you look at quantum mechanics, it ties it to space-time. That is the mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they have to say that wave-particle duality exists, which is a dichotomy. The issue is they really, in the early stages, should have expanded their reference frame to take something else more than space-time, as we're doing now. But the key part is, if you want to think about it, think of all of our, in quantum mechanics, all the potential functions are in space and time. Now, when you start thinking about consciousness, and there's so much data that shows that it's beyond space and time, mm-hmm. you can't even define a potential function for that. And therefore, you cannot solve Schrodinger's equation. You can't do the kinds of things that are done very well in classical quantum mechanics. But when you're talking about psychoenergetic processes, and all of humans, they're just full of psychoenergetic processes, our present formulation of quantum mechanics can't touch it. Now, let me say, a lot of people who talk about these things, they use quantum mechanics as a vehicle, and it is more hopefulness. That's really what they're saying. I mean, the way you need to interpret what they're saying is that quantum mechanics should have these capabilities within it. Mm-hmm. And what I'm talking about is, sure, let's expand quantum mechanics in the direction that I'm talking about. I'm not for throwing it out. I'm just saying it needs terrible expansion, large expansion, because in its basic mathematical formulation, it doesn't go far enough.
But you do understand, Professor, why people see the parallel on the surface.
Oh, sure. I mean, because in it turns out that the things that they're applying quantum mechanics to is that once you accept wave-particle duality,
uh-huh.
you can solve all the mathematics in space-time, but I'm saying the non-local forces, the information entanglement, those kinds of things, they're really tapping into this other level, this duplex space level. So I'm saying that, that the mathematics of quantum mechanics at this point in time are, they're convenient.
Right.
But they will not carry us to where we need to go.
All right. We don't have a lot of time left. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Tiller. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor Tiller. Before I pose my question, I would like to first thank you for your affirmations of the purpose of science tonight, which is to prove the existence of a creator, not to deny it.
Yes.
With that being as it is, my question is, it seems from what I heard tonight, from tonight's interview, I have understood that intentions are as a vehicle, so sincerity should be the fuel. With the right sincere intentions, can we be elevated to a higher state of being? And if so, could that be the purpose of intentions?
All right.
To propel us to a higher state of being.
All right, we're out of time. So, Professor?
Okay. It's a good question. Intention to me is an imprint from the domain of spirit onto the domain of mind, which then goes through all the other levels of reality. And we're in this classroom, which is like a teaching machine. And so the spirit learns and grows. So there's a real connection, but now you're getting my speculation. I have no scientific proof of this at this point in time, but I hope to get it before I die.
And I hope you are able to stay around for a long time, Professor.
I just started the fourth quarter, and I'm planning on at least two overtimes.
What you've done is absolutely mind-boggling. It underscores so many other things we've talked about on this program, and I don't know, it seems like yourself and some of these others ought to get together in some grand consciousness forum and share your ideas and work.
I think indeed, and I have no doubt that that will happen as time goes on.
All right, Professor, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and you have a wonderful week.
Thanks, and you too.
Take care, Professor. There you have it, Professor William A. Tiller.